Hello and welcome to another episode of the M2.0 series of Ampule. Thanks for joining us today on the Australian Medical Students Association podcast. My name is Liz and I will be your host for today's episode with special guest, Associate Professor Charlie Cork. Charlie is one of Australia's leading intensive care specialists and a past president and vice president of the College of Intensive Care of Australia and New Zealand. Charlie is passionate about advanced care planning and lectures widely on medical communication and end-of-life decision-making. Charlie was generous enough to sit down with me today to discuss some key concepts about patient-centered care and particularly how to actually implement these in end-of-life care. He shared some incredible practical tips on how to actively involve patients, their loved ones, as well as colleagues in conversations surrounding end-of-life decision-making, even in a disease-focused clinical environment. So I hope you enjoy today's episode as much as I did recording it. Thanks for joining us. Before going any further, I would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which we all reside, in what is known as Australia, as well as the Wurundjeri people, who are the traditional custodians of the place of recording. I extend my respects to elders of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, past, present, and emerging. AMSA acknowledges that the sovereignty of this land has never been ceded, and that this land was, and always will be, Aboriginal land.
I'm only human, can you see? I made a mistake. Please just look me in my face. Tell me everything's okay. Cause I got it. Ooh, never be like you.
Thank you so much for joining me this morning, Charlie. I really appreciate you setting aside the time to have a chat to us about end-of-life care for our listeners. Are you able to start us off by just giving us a brief introduction into who you are?
Well, yes, I'm Charlie Cork. I'm an intensivist. I've been an intensivist for a very long time, nearly 30 years.
Oh, wow.
I know it's a long time. Past president of the College of Intensive Care Medicine. And I suppose, you know, as well as qualifying in medicine, I did a combined degree in psychology, and I've always throughout my career been interested in what makes people tick and trying to understand people and trying to deliver the medicine that people want rather than the medicine that we want to give.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I feel that medicine is a very privileged profession because, you know, it combines so many elements of things that I like and I think others like that I work with. You know, of the science plus the humanity together. Mm. And I think we're very lucky to be in that.
Mm, yeah. You have a lot of experience working around advocating for end-of-life care and early shared decision-making.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for agreeing to share this with us today. So firstly, I'd really like to get a little bit more of the definitions behind it. Would you mind talking our listeners through what the components of a good death and what's important to consider with our patients?
Yes, I think that a good death involves not being abandoned, being looked after right to the end, and avoiding the things at the end that you want to avoid, that you're worried about. Mm. And everyone has, dying is not a great prospect. It's a scary prospect.
Mm.
But as well as that, living in a dreadful way is a horrible prospect as well. And if we only talk about dying and avoiding it, you really have a very restricted approach to end of life. And in a way, medicine has moved us there a bit because avoiding dying is the major thing that we're taught about.
Mm, yeah.
Preventing dying. And a lot of our research is around Kaplan-Meier curves and mortality rates. And, you know, if our mortality is less, then the treatment works. There's nothing about miserably living in a Kaplan-Meier curve.
Yeah, that's very.
But, of course, that's a worry to people. So for me, in talking about end-of-life care, is about talking about unacceptable living as much as talking about dying.
Mm.
And when you talk about unacceptable living, people are quite happy to talk about what they're worried about. And which of us wouldn't be interested in telling somebody about things that we're worried about that we'd really like to avoid?
Mm.
So the way that you bring up the conversation and talk is very important.
Mm.
But so much of medicine is about, at the moment, is that feeling of there's nothing I can do, so I'm powerless and you're on your own, which is a dreadful way to approach the situation and very scary for patients. And it doesn't need to be like that.
Mm. Why do you think it is so difficult for us to let someone die in medicine?
Well, because it's so easy not to. It's so easy to prevent someone dying. There's something you can do. And particularly with modern medicine, of course, as an intensivist, you know, I've got all access to the machines and the life support can be pushed to a limit in almost everybody now.
Mm.
And so not doing something for someone who's capable of doing something and feels that doing something is the right, you know, is what we're about, becomes really difficult.
Mm.
And on top of that, there's a whole range of people around the place. There's all the family who can attack you for not doing it, and your colleagues who can attack you for not doing it. And that perception that a good doctor can save people where the poor doctor can't.
Mm.
And so there's something professional about it as well. And it does frustrate me that over the years I've had to counsel so many young doctors who feel a personal responsibility when a patient has died, that could they have not done something more? And in these cases, almost always, a few exceptions, but in almost all the cases, the patient was dying.
Mm.
It was quite clear that the patient was dying, and nothing that could have been done would have changed it. And more strenuous efforts potentially could have made the death more drawn out and unpleasant.
Mm.
But there is nothing for the junior doctor to be worried about. But they're really, really upset
Mm.
that they're responsible.
Mm.
And I think we need to change that. And I certainly, after someone's died, more often than not, because of the way that we've approached it, feel that we did a good job. And we get the best cards and the best thanks back from the relatives,
Mm.
from patients who die well.
Yeah, absolutely. It's such an important part of medical care that we don't put enough emphasis on, I don't think, in the current medical model. How do you think medicine needs to change to include this?
I think we need to embrace death as part of what we do. I think we need to move from a perception that our job is to prevent death to a perception that our job is to improve lives, which includes avoiding death when it's appropriate, embracing it when it's not, you know, when it's inevitable, and when it's, and particularly, you know, listening to patients, because patients that I talk to, honestly, many will tell you whether they are at a stage of their life where they wish to fight or they wish to be more accepting.
Mm.
And we all would like, not all of us, but the vast majority of us would like to live as long as possible. But there's some provisos in that. We want to live as long as possible with quality.
Mm.
But that's a very personal thing of what that quality is, of how much compromise we're prepared to accept is incredibly variable. There are some people that are tough as nuts and they'll cope with stuff that's really surprising just to stay alive. There are others who value quality very, very highly. And as soon as it starts to go, they're ready to go.
Mm.
And you've got to listen to them. So, and I find that really fascinating, that just listening to people and delivering the care that they want, particularly at this really, really complex, difficult, scary time,
Mm.
is very much valued.
Mm. How did you first come to the understanding that not everyone has this intrinsic desire to live and to survive?
Oh, just by listening to people. And I mean, certainly in intensive care, there are a number of patients where I made, you know, had to make decisions to save somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always made an important part of my practice to talk to, when we've had discussions with families or we've made decisions ourselves to intervene, to check with patients when they survive whether we did the right thing. It's not a hard thing to do. It's a natural thing to do. And I've been surprised how many say, well, okay, I'm happy with what you did, but don't do it again.
Okay.
And, I accept that you did it, and I accept you did it for the right reasons, but if it happens again, don't do it.
Yeah, right.
So it's not obvious that people always want to survive. And I think you'll all find that when you speak to patients and listen to them, people are quite nuanced. I've done quite a bit of research on this and discovered that around 7% really want everything, anything that's offered. But the other 93% are quite nuanced in what they're prepared to accept and what they'd like to avoid. And I think exploring that's always, for me, been a really interesting thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And emphasizes the importance of having advanced care directives in place as early as possible, because you never know when you're quite going to need it. Do you find it difficult to talk to patients about their end of life care goals?
No, I don't. It's something we do all the time. We teach to junior doctors to do all the time. And hospitals are increasingly acquiring goals of care forms to be filled out. So junior doctors have to do this very quickly and very frequently in early practice. Mm. And I think the importance is having a language and listening to people who can do it well and learning quickly how to do it well. And just being interested for a patient, your doctor being showing an interest in you as a person, most people react to very positively. And I think it's about not talking about how would you like to die is a shocking question. How would you like the end bit to be is not the way to do it. It's about saying, are the things that you'd like us to work together to avoid, are the things that you're worried about?
Yeah.
Tell me about what's important to you to make your life meaningful and what's unacceptable for you. And people are interesting. They come up with some interesting things, and it's with a little bit of listening, I don't find it difficult to come up with a plan with them that they feel quite relieved about. And you mentioned advanced care planning before. Of course, advanced care planning sort of helps because it gets half the job done before you see somebody. And I'm very keen for everybody to have advanced care plans. And it's a hard thing to get people to do, but I think it's a good thing to do. Very good.
Absolutely. You've also done a lot of work around advocating for improving health literacy in people's understanding of what end-of-life care actually looks like and what different interventions look like. Are you able to talk us through the exhibition that you had in Melbourne, how you have those discussions around helping patients understand what their options actually are?
Yes, well, we had this issue that I just talked about, that people aren't that keen to do advanced care planning. They don't really recognise the need, and there's nothing triggers them off. So it's a hard thing to advertise and push. Mm-hmm. So as an experiment to try and see if we could generate a bit more discussion, I made a model, or got made by very good film prop production people, a model of a 91-year-old lady, and I have found this great 91-year-old lady with super wrinkly, lovely wrinkles, very dignified lady. And I got her modeled in silicon, and she was very, very happy to do it and had great fun doing it, and it was a good project. And then we put a tracheostomy in her and a urinary catheter and a few other things, and stuck her in bed and took her onto South Bank, and to show and to look at how people responded. And it's interesting, you know, about 95% of people looked at her and thought, I would never want to end up like that. There's something not right here. And 5% were feeling that it was a good thing that we were looking after, you know, that she was in that situation and being cared for. Which is about the same as the population approach to this sort of thing that I've found in the research. So it's out there, but it certainly got people to think about planning. And it was a great project.
How do you translate that to, or how do you suggest junior doctors translate that to an acute situation in the ED when you're trying to fill out that form, communicating with your patient exactly what their options are?
Well, I mean, it's important perhaps as a junior doctor not to get too tied up with the actual interventions and to talk about more large picture things of outcomes that are unacceptable to somebody. So the values that seem to be come up in the research and come up in clinical practice are around dignity.
Mm.
So what is undignified for you? What is unacceptably undignified for you as an outcome? And it's more outcomes than treatments.
Yeah.
People will go through all sorts of things in treatment, but it's where that treatment takes you. So indignity, independence, and the opposite of independence is burden. Mm. And a lot of people talk about not wanting to be a burden. Mm. Suffering. So we want to avoid suffering and pain and suffering, but suffering more than pain. I mean, obviously pain leads to suffering.
Mm.
And those things are relatively easy to talk about. And we don't have to know about the treatment and things. It's about how far you want, how much investment you want to get for how much output,
mm.
and whether that's acceptable. And certainly you see patients very, well, I see patients regularly who have very clear limits and they're very clear about it. And it's very helpful when the patient is very clear and their family are very clear,
mm.
and agree. And they've got it organized. It's not, you don't see it that often, but when you see it, it's really very helpful mm. that everyone's already on the page before you start. But of course, for many junior doctors doing this, you find that patients aren't quite, you know, either they haven't started at all or they've only gone a little way, and you need some words that prompt people to be able to explain where they are on that spectrum mm. of do everything and never stop. Don't even start.
Mm.
We'll do a little bit. Now, we want to know how much, you know, where someone is. Yeah. That's how I think about it. I want to know where you are on the spectrum.
Mm. Do you have any tips for anyone who's interested in running a project like this?
I've discovered that with the health department and the government that we work with, if you're trying to do something that's the opposite of what their current, or not just the opposite, but it just doesn't align with their priorities at the time, trying to convince people to support you is terribly difficult. You can have the best idea, but if it's at the wrong time, it doesn't really work. On the other hand, if you have an idea that links with what they've got in their mind at the time, it's so easy. So I think I've wasted many years with good ideas at the time when people who have the finances and the ability to help you to achieve it are just not interested. And then I come up with a mediocre idea at the time when they're keen, and it works. And I think it's a good idea, certainly whenever you've got a good idea, to have a look and see whether it fits in with a program that's going on.
You mentioned families when they're on board can be quite helpful in the process where there's not a common understanding between the patient and the family. Do you find that they're helpful or unhelpful in the process?
Oh, no. If the family haven't been brought on board before with any discussion, they're often can be quite difficult. There are two big drivers for families. One is duty, my duty to get the best for my family member and look after them, and love. If you love someone, you never let them go.
Yeah.
And both of those things are quite contrary to accepting not pushing and pushing and pushing. And I see lots, I mean, my classic is an older lady that I see in emergency with some utter catastrophe, you know, intra-abdominal catastrophe or something that's already, you know, very frail and bedridden and in trouble. You talk to them and they say, I don't want surgery. I don't want anything. I just want to be comfortable.
Mm.
And then half an hour after their family have come, they want surgery.
Mm.
And I go back and say, well, told me very clearly you didn't before. Have you changed your mind? And they say, well, I haven't changed my mind, but my family have, you know, coerced me.
Yep.
They don't use the word coerce, but they mean it.
Yep.
So family can be quite, can make death, you know, in their efforts for all the right reasons, they can make the end quite difficult. And I've had a number of patients that I've had in intensive care for a very long period of time because the family have forced it, and the patients have died in the end, inevitably, but they've pushed for this end that was probably exactly the opposite of what, in fact, they've told me it's exactly the opposite of what the patient wants, but they demand it. It's very frustrating.
Mm.
So you don't want your family to be terrible to you at the end. Try and avoid it.
Absolutely, which brings up the importance of having those discussions
early in the piece. Do you think that advanced care directives or just having these discussions with your loved ones, do you think that we need to implement public policy or change GP funding to ensure that this becomes standard practice?
Well, I think both. I've written a book called Letting Go, which was I've written for the public to understand what all this is about. And it would also be something I think that medical students would find very useful to understand a bit of the process as well. In terms of general practice, I did an interesting study where we went to some GP practices were producing a lot of advanced care plans that were very good and others were producing none. And we went and listened to how the doctors were talking to the patients, the ones who were good and the ones who were bad. And the ones who were good were doing had a number of tactics that were really quite interesting. They normalized it. One of the GPs who's particularly good at it spoke about how he'd done his. And he thought that it'd be good if they did theirs. And that was very empowering.
Right.
And it was about avoiding things you don't want rather than planning to reject things.
Yeah.
And it was all much more about those things I talked about independence, suffering and dignity rather than about any particular treatments. And then we went to the ones who, the ones who didn't do it well, just were talking about how do you want to die? And that just sort of makes people say, I'd rather not talk about it.
Yeah.
So, and I think in general practice, obviously the funding thing is a problem that you do need to have something, some incentive that makes this discussion, because general practice obviously is the place to do it. And it's just not happening at the moment. And I think there are a number of disincentives to doing it.
Absolutely. And do you think that there should be common process before elective surgery for all ages? I'm just familiar with at the moment of a case of a boy who went in for surgery, which unfortunately had nasty outcomes or adverse outcomes. And he was very clear that there were certain outcomes he wasn't comfortable with or happy with and never put advanced care directive in place. And so now his family are going to the nth degree. Is there anything you think we can do to avoid this happening?
No, I think it is important. If you're going to any high risk, potentially high risk surgery, it's obviously a good idea to set a safety net. That's how I see it. It's a safety net that if all goes wrong, you're not expecting to fall, but if you fall, it's nice to have a safety net under you to prevent things happening that you don't want. And certainly these goals of care plans are more relevant in those who are higher risk. So the higher risk, the more important it is to have these plans. But, everybody probably needs to do it. And, terrible things can happen to young people. Anyone who drives home can have a terrible car accident and end up in a minimally aware state any day. And, I've got a plan. I'm just, in the same way as I've got house fire insurance, I've got a plan. Why wouldn't you have a plan? And when we had last week we had an unfortunate man who's got had a locked-in syndrome. He was able to communicate with us moving his eyes. And it can happen. And, within the unit we're discussing how many people would want life support, to be us to fight to keep them alive in that situation. And there was nobody in our unit who wanted it. But of course, none of them have got advanced care plans because they're all young.
Yeah, it's something that I think it's a cultural shift and an awareness that we need to change.
But it's like I'd say my likeness is likening it to fire insurance. If you've got a house, you have a fire insurance. You don't do it because you think the house is going to burn down.
Yeah.
You do it because it's just sensible.
Yeah, why wouldn't you put down on paper what your wishes are? It makes absolute sense.
Why not? Exactly.
Yeah.
And just describe a situation that you won't accept. And if the answer is you can't think of one, you'll accept everything. Well, write that down and we'll know. And then if something ghastly happens, I'll feel okay treating you.
Mm. What do you think students can do to get better at starting these conversations or providing patient-centered care?
I think you've got to practice. It's not easy. And I find that when I'm first teaching medical students and junior doctors, they rumble around and find it really quite every word feels awkward. And it's difficult to get your message across in a way that doesn't seem like you're destroying hope or you're being horrible or you're destroying the relationship. All of those things are, you can see that people are terribly worried about all of those things. So getting your language right. And the other thing is that you can't just use a script. You know, when people read this stuff out of a script, it just sounds shocking. So you've got to get your own spiel and get it right. As well, I would suggest that students might do my Christmas dinner test, which is to discuss it with your family around Christmas dinner about what they want and what they don't want. And you'll find, I'll be very surprised if you find that all of your family want to go into a nursing home with a trachea and a peg tube. Mm. You're not going to find that. You'll find that they'll say, just deal with me, push me off a cliff. I never want that to happen.
Yeah.
And when you're saying that, I don't think the people that you're seeing in the clinic are different from your family. In fact, I'm sure they're not. They're the same.
Yeah.
So it's the same. We're all the same. There are things we worry about. We want to live well. We don't want to live badly. We definitely don't want to live a long time very, very, very badly. And we're entitled to express our view. And although we may slide into it and there may be nothing we can do about it, we do have the power if we are fighting like mad. It does seem a shame when we fight like mad for an outcome that somebody definitely would not consent to. It does seem a bit mad to me.
Yeah, absolutely.
To do that.
And such a big use of resources at the same time. Mm-hmm. Besides discussing more of a focus around the outcomes rather than the interventions itself, do you have any other recommendations to make the conversation less avoidable with patients or loved ones?
Less avoidable? You mean more effective?
Yeah, so we have such a tendency to avoid the difficult conversations around death, kind of brush it off.
Yes, I have a little thing that I teach that I call WOW, W-O-W. The first W is worry. So you need to tell the patient what you personally or the team as a whole are worried about.
Okay.
What's ahead of them that you are worrying about? It's not fair to allow patients to wander into this end bit without knowing what's ahead and that there may be choices.
Mm-hmm.
So you tell them, we're a bit worried. And I find worry a great word because your mum's worried when you go out in the evening. It doesn't mean you can't go. It's because she cares about you.
Yeah.
And when someone worries about you, you can reject it and say, yeah, you're worried, but I'm pretty confident. I'm all right. I'll be fine. Mm-hmm. So worry's a nice way just to raise it. And then the O is open. You just listen to people, how they respond to that worry and what they're, you know, you said, I'm worried about this in the future. And they can say, oh, well, I'm not. Or they can say, well, yes, I am too. And you listen to how they're reacting to what you think is coming up in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And if they want to avoid it, they will put on the table how they're feeling about it. And then the second W is to wonder. So on the basis of what you've just told me about what you're not wanting and what you're worried about, I'm wondering whether if we were to give you fluids and antibiotics and try and keep you on the ward, keep you in the nursing home and do that, whether that would be a good plan.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, when you're wondering, again, the patient can easily say, well, no, I don't think so. I think I'd want to do more than that, a bit more than that. Or, but mostly if you actually base it on what they've just told you, most people feel, oh, that sounds like quite a decent plan.
Yeah.
So it's not about you taking anything away from them. It's about you working with them to reflect their priorities in the plan that you're coming up with.
Mm.
And I found that WOW is a very simple little structure that works incredibly well for me.
Mm, yeah, no, it's really insightful.
And for those we teach as well, because it just takes away those things that junior doctors really worry about.
Yeah, absolutely. You alluded to when you try to do this the first couple of times and it doesn't necessarily go well. Are you able to tell us about a time where that's happened for you and what you've learned from it?
Well, I think we've all done that, where we try and it's probably when you're trying to be too quick and you're not listening to the patient enough and you're talking to someone. And also someone, you walk into a patient, you think the patient understands a bit about where they are in their you know, their disease trajectory. And they haven't got a clue. You know, they've been looked after and the doctors who are looking after them have never told them that this is a progressive disease that's going to catch up with them. and it comes as a big surprise to them. And so if you're not careful, you can put your foot in it and get far too far in far too quickly and lose rapport. So it's like everything in medicine. It's a good thing to go in gently and work out where the patient's at first and then to move on. And I've certainly put my foot in it by assuming people were at a different place than I thought they were, different awareness and that literacy. I'm always trying to learn more about how to deliver better care, how to listen to patients better, and now how to teach others to do the things that it's taken me 30 years to work out. I'm trying to share with younger doctors and get them up to speed much quicker than I got.
Yeah, absolutely.
No, but it's one of the joys of medicine, I think, teaching and sharing. And I get so much from interacting with junior doctors and medical students. Just the enthusiasm and the willingness to learn and the excitement at the beginning of a career is something that's very life enhancing.
Yeah.
Yes, that's right.
As we do live in such a disease-focused clinical environment currently, how do you go about advocating for patients and getting that patient-centered care?
That's a great question. It is difficult, and you may, if you're in a team where everyone else is disease-centered and you're trying to bring in a patient-centered approach, you have to be very careful. And it is interesting, you know, the data that patient-centered approach is much more evident within talking to medical students than it is talking to middle grade doctors who've come in with that but have sort of thrown it away because it's just easier to do a disease-centered approach and everyone around you is doing it.
Right.
So I think if you're in that environment, I find that if you give it all away, as some doctors do, I think you become a very perhaps a heartless doctor and perhaps not the sort of doctor that most people would aspire to go to as the doctor who cares for them. I just think you've got to, if everyone around you is doing disease-centered, you just have to, you're the one who sprinkles the fairy dust of patient-centeredness into the system and just alert others to what the patient's thinking. Most doctors, once they are aware and confident about what patients are thinking, even if they won't ask them themselves, will take it on board. But that's the art of teamwork in medicine, is taking things in the right direction without causing upset.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you have any recommendations on how to interact with these disease-focused colleagues to bring the emphasis back to patient-centered care?
Well, just to slip in conversation about what the patient's told you, slip in conversation and slip into the notes about what they're saying and what they're concerned about. Ensure the patient talks to their family so that you've got the patient and the family contributing the patient-centered approach to the interaction with the doctors, and not allowing a disease-centered process to dominate completely.
Yeah, absolutely. How do you yourself with such, because it takes quite a lot of compassion and insight to consider the patient-centered approach, how do you prevent that compassion burnout and fatigue in yourself and avoid from coming one of those disease-focused clinicians?
Just because doing it is the best sort of medicine. I think the burnout is in producing medicine that people don't want, is depressing and awful. I think listening to people, interacting with people, and medicine as a patient-centered, caring interaction keeps me interested and keeps me feeling confident that we're doing the right thing. So, no, I think it's a life-enhancing activity rather than anything relating to burnout.
Yeah, okay.
For me, certainly.
Yeah, absolutely. So engaging in something that you find fulfilling for the patients, you find fulfilling in yourself.
Totally, and for families. I was working yesterday, and I just walked out of my intensive care unit with a relative who'd, obviously just been through something that was very traumatic, And I took the time to walk out with her. It was only a little thing, but it was, it's appreciated. It's those little things that are always appreciated that we perhaps undervalue, but they're very important because families need that permission and relief that they're doing the right thing. And if you just dangle the medical disease centered thing in front of them, they can't resist it.
Mm.
And even when you're doing it, you know it's not quite right. And I find it a bit frustrating when I speak to colleagues who tell me that the patients and families are demanding treatment that they think is absolutely ridiculous. And when you talk to the families, you discover that really they think there's only one choice and that they've agreed to the only thing that was offered.
Yeah, yeah, it is very much painted as a dichotomous kind of option, or we do nothing or we do everything.
Yes, and that's never the option. That's a very bad way to say it. I think in many things in medicine now, there are always more than one option, and you need to present the options, you know, honestly and straightforwardly.
Mm.
And certainly doing nothing is not, I never do nothing.
Mm. In those settings, with how multicultural Australia is, do you ever find that cultural barriers prevent you from seeking the patient's understanding of what they're wanting?
It can be more difficult, but I think if you're not talking about treatments and you're talking about life's priorities, you can talk about that to anybody.
Yeah.
And whatever culture people come from, the things about dignity, burden, and suffering are there in us all.
With, I guess, my example comes back to a hypothetical that was posed to me by my ethics and legal subject, where they discussed the cultural differences and culture where they didn't want to tell the mother that they had a terminal illness. How do you suggest facilitating these conversations without getting people offside?
It can be difficult, but understanding that. So I think everyone has in patient autonomy, you have the right to delegate the decision to somebody else if you don't want to make the decision, culturally or personally. But if that's delegated to somebody else, then that person needs to be fully informed in the same way.
Mm.
And at the same time as the patient is delegating, they probably, I say to patients, yes, I'm perfectly happy to talk to your family about it, but I'd like you to give them some guidance about what's important to you and what you'd want to avoid.
Mm.
Because without that, they will not be able to, I don't think they'll be able to make a good decision for you if they don't know what matters to you.
Mm.
And again, people generally think that's pretty sensible. And with the families, you just try and keep the conversation on what the patient wants, because the families commonly tell you what they want. And that's nice, but it's got nothing to do with it. It's about what the patient wants. So their role is to advocate for the patient, not to advocate what they want. And as soon as they say, we want, or I want you to, I reject that and bring them back to the patient.
Yeah.
And it is interesting when they're having, I want you to do this, but I know it's what mum won't want. Mum would never want it. How can you have a conversation like that?
When you're looking at end-of-life care, there comes up the question of competence and being able to assess a patient's competence. How do you balance that in terms of being able to identify patients' wishes if they don't necessarily have that competence?
Well, of course, we come back to where you were before about the need to do it in advance. So the further away from the crisis that the discussion is had about what's important and what people want to avoid, the better.
Mm-hmm.
In a crisis, or hopefully before the crisis, in the early stages when somebody comes into hospital or starts to deteriorate, there can be opportunity to have the conversation before they become unconscious. I do find it frustrating, and you will find it frustrating when you become junior doctors, that there are patients who've been in hospital for 3 days talking quite sensibly who then crash, and then everybody says, I wonder what they wanted. Well, there were 3 days you could have asked them what they wanted.
Yeah.
It's interesting. We have this thing, we mustn't talk to patients until they can't talk to you. And that's just a silliness, isn't it? So getting on with it. And then asking questions in a very simple way, and checking that thing we do with for informed consent, you know, the ability for the patient to hear what we're saying, the ability to synthesize it, and the ability to give us a rational answer or an answer that they can rationalize. Mm. And we test that. But it is frustrating if you leave it till the last minute and then they're a bit, you know, we're not entirely sure that what they're saying is completely, that they have complete capacity at that time. And then the family saying, oh, mum, we don't believe that she was in the right state when she said it. But it is a self-inflicted thing if we don't do it when we could do it.
Mm. And that, because it is such a personalised conversation and such a personalised thing, how do we balance between being protocolized and making sure we do this in a timely manner to keeping it patient-centered and personalized?
Well, I think all systems work better if you've got some time limits that you've got to do things, if we know that there's nothing. And it has been classically a job which everyone thinks should be done but leaves to somebody else.
Mm.
And none of, you know, we all should do it, but we all don't do it. And at the end of the day, nobody's done it because everyone should do it. I think having a system where you do attempt to do it to all patients within a reasonable time. But my dream is that, you know, that this will be done by people themselves because they want to do it in the community beforehand with advanced care plans. GPs will do it regularly and just have a chat. It'll become part of the armamentarium of how are you going, and that plan you did last year, is that still what you want? And my experience is if you ask for the plan in terms of what's important to you in your life and how, you know, what's unacceptable to you, what's unacceptable to you now and the way you are as a character probably is the same as you'll be when you're 90.
Mm.
You don't change. All the people who were irritating when I was at university are still irritated. No, they don't change. They don't change. Things that, you know, things that people were campaigning about at university, they're still doing it. You know, it's about your character and who you are, yeah, which is why it's lovely. It doesn't change. So if we avoid talking about treatments and we talk about priorities, then that doesn't change. So we can do that early on. Mm-hmm. And I'd like many more people to come into hospital with that understanding of where they are on that spectrum about going on and on and on and trying. There are no limits. There are lots of limits, and I only want a little bit or somewhere in between. And you can move it a little bit on the scale, but in my experience, you don't get people go from one end of the scale to the other end of the scale. They don't do that very much. They have a right to, but they don't do it as much as people would suggest.
Mm, yeah, because there is that suggestion that we really need to keep it up to date. And
yeah,
whether the current advanced care directive can be relied upon if it's done more than a certain time frame beforehand?
Yes.
What are your thoughts?
Well, I think I will not do that. What I would do would be to say that if it's been done in advance, when the patient comes in, you should check it. So what I say to patients is, that's what you wrote last time. Is that still what you think? And 95% of people go, yes. Well, that wasn't a very long conversation. That was easy. Mm. And then the ones who want to change it, but they only change it a little bit.
Mm.
So having something to work with is better than nothing. If the thing is not being updated and the patient no longer can say anything, it's probably like a will that it's the last thing that was done. It probably stands. But we certainly should be checking, but I don't think we should be assuming, as we do at the moment, that everything that was done in the past is completely invalid and needs to be thrown away. Mm. And we've got to start with a blank sheet of paper. That's horrible workload for junior doctors if we take that attitude. And I don't think there's any justification for it.
Mm.
It's like saying if your will was written, you know, 3 years ago, it's invalid.
Mm.
And you've got to do a new one.
Yeah.
Because you probably, you know, your children might have upset you in the meantime.
Very true. So I also wanted to see if you wouldn't mind commenting around the central theme of what would have been the conference, new perspectives. Would you mind sharing what new perspectives means to you and a perspective or mantra that you like to live every day by?
Well, I'm obviously going to go back to what we've talked about. I think this is a new perspective, moving seriously from a disease-centered approach to a patient-centered approach, making medicine deliver what people want in a much better way is the mantra. It's the new perspective, an important perspective.
Mm.
Exciting, I think.
Yeah. Do you think there's anything we can be doing in universities for medical students to help encourage this change in approach to medicine?
I think universities are doing a great job on patient-centered care. I think probably the bit that I'd like to see is to see it preserved as you move into clinical practice, to keep the seeds that have been sown in universities alive and thriving.
Yeah, okay.
So I think universities are doing a good job.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing probably is, you know, to have some literature and some support that help people to be able to do this better, because it is awful when you do it badly and get hurt in the early stages of trying to do patient-centered care, and not getting the message over right can be, you know, we're also sensitive about it, that if we upset patients and suggest that we don't know what to do, or that we're asking them to make the choice about what medical care they should have, and they, you know, the worst answer is when they say to, well, you're the doctor, you should know. Why are you asking me what to do? You must be hopeless. Mm. You know, that's not the message you want to get back.
Mm.
So I think the universities are great, and I think they've gone a long way. I think we're developing shared decision making. There are all sorts of models. You know, you get a lovely idea, and you know, within seconds, there's all sorts of different models, and it becomes all very complicated. I'm a person who likes to have things, do things in a simple way, because I think that's easier to remember and easier to do.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And I think this can be one of that.
Well, thank you so much for your time. You've been delightful and so insightful.
Good.
Thank you so much again.
Thank you very much. Well done.
Thanks so much for joining me for today's episode of the AMSA Ampoule podcast M 2.0 series. Our code word this week is the word brunch, which if you go to our website, www.m2020.com.au, and insert the code word into our portal, you'll go into the running for some great prizes, as well as the opportunity to complete our sticker book. The M 2.0 series is a subset of Ampoule, the Australian Medical Students Association ongoing podcast series to highlight the speakers who would have been at our AMSA Melbourne 2020 National Convention. If you would like to learn more about our podcast, you can visit our website, www.m2020.com.au, or our parent website, www.amsa.org.au. Or if you prefer, we're on social media as AMSA National Convention on both Facebook and Instagram. For more information on the topics covered in today's podcast, you can read Charlie's book called Letting Go in the link provided. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the speakers and do not definitively represent those of AMSA or their subsidiaries. If you'd like to know more about the public policies, please visit our website, www.amsa.org.au, and select Advocacy followed by Official Policy. This episode of Ampoule was hosted and edited by Alyssa Viziani, with guest Associate Professor Charlie Cork, with music by James Palmier and credit music by Nick Barrett.